You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Jeffrey Couchman is here to talk about a new biography he's written, but it's a biography of a film, specifically The Night of the Hunter, a 1955 movie which starred Robert Mitchum, Shelley Winters, and Lillian Gish, and was directed by actor Charles Laughton. It's been chosen by the Library of Congress for the National Film Registry and is on many people's lists as one of the best films ever, yet it is often overlooked. Jeffrey Couchman tells the story behind the film now in his book called The Night of the Hunter. It's been published by Northwestern University Press. I'm very pleased he could join me. Hello.
Hi. Thanks very much for having me here. This is great.
So what made you call this book a biography?
Well, it's the story of both the novel, the beginning life of this film, and how it was then developed into a screenplay, how it developed into a film, what happened afterwards. It's truly, this film has a life, and I felt from birth to death and resurrection is what we have with The Night of the Hunter, because it died at the box office and has since become known as a classic, of course.
Now, when you came in here, you asked me if I remember the first time I saw the film. Do you remember the first time you saw it?
Oh, yeah. I was probably about 10, and my father had said, you have to see this movie. It's on The Late Show. You're going to never forget this film. And well, he was right. It just made a huge impression on me. The image of Shelley Winters under the water stuck with me for years and years, and it's probably the reason I wanted to write the book. I just became obsessed with this film. It scares you as a kid, especially because it taps into some primal fear of being alone in an adult world where everybody's betrayed you and everyone has left you alone, and you're the only one who can see through this monster.
Well, it's not the kind of film that I would recommend for children because it's so scary, and maybe even more so because children play key roles in it.
Yes, yes, and it's such real. I mean, I love monster movies, you know, the 50s stuff with the giant ants and invaders from Mars and all that stuff. That was great. I wasn't scared by those, but this is real. This is somebody you could actually think was in your house ready to attack you, and it gets you in a way that is much more real, yeah. Although there was a listing of best films by The Guardian, best family films of all time, and Night of the Hunter is
really
on The Guardian's list of best family films, which cracked me up.
I don't get that. Robert Mitchum, who stars as the Reverend Harry Powell, is enough to give anyone nightmares in this film.
Down those stairs, he says. Yeah.
Well, he has the words love and hate tattooed across the knuckles of each hand, and that it gives us a real insight from the start as to what kind of guy he is.
Yes, yes. And that love and hate, he tells the story of good and evil, and he uses the tattoos on his fingers to tell the arm wrestle of good and evil, and he mesmerizes people with this sermon that he has. He's quite an actor, Harry Powell. And the kid, of course, John Harper, sees right through him, and the only one. And that, you can tell Harry Powell loves that as well. That's a game for him. He likes being able to fool people. He also likes it that someone sees through him, and now he can manipulate this kid as well.
And Robert Mitchum seems to be perfect for the part, although in retrospect, I think if I were a casting director, I probably would have picked Burt Lancaster because he was the actor for that kind of part, Elma Gantry and the such. But Mitchum is much scarier.
Much scarier. Very, very strange choice. Actually, Paul Gregory, the producer, had wanted Laurence Olivier in the role, and he even thought about Jack Lemmon, incredibly enough. Although,
How old was Jack Lemmon at the time?
I'm not sure. He was very young, and a couple years after this, Paul Gregory did put him on a TV show, The Day the Lincoln Was Shot, a wonderful show, and Lemmon plays John Wilkes Booth. And it was a time when he was known only as comic actor. He'd won his Academy Award as Ensign Pulver and Mr. Roberts. But Gregory could see something more in him, could see a deeper sort of actor, and he's chilling as John Wilkes Booth. He might actually have been sort of interesting, but Mitchum goes over the top with the performance. Unlike anything in his entire career, he's such an understated actor normally. Here, he's just having the time of his life playing this part to the hilt.
Do you think it's because the director was a great actor?
I think he absorbed something of Lawton's extravagance, because Lawton was known for these over-the-top effects, even brushing his lip in Mutiny on the Bounty seems a huge effect. Everything he did was large, and Mitchum...
He played Henry VIII.
Yeah, oh, Henry VIII with that chicken bone throwing it over his shoulder. Yes, everything was big, and it seems as if somehow Mitchum absorbed that quality. Paul Gregory once said that Lawton took over everything and everybody he worked with. You know, everybody became partly him, so Mitchum somehow must have been influenced.
Did Lawton have theories about acting as art or entertainment?
I don't think he had any theories specifically about art, of acting, but he did believe that there was very little blurring of art and entertainment. He and Paul Gregory both believed that art can be entertainment, entertainment can be art, and they had no use for this highbrow, lowbrow distinction. And
even though today this would be seen as an arty independent film.
That's right. Absolutely. And at the time, arty was a word that the reviewers used over and over in the 50s. And that, of course, killed it. You know, it's arty. It means pretentious. And Cortez once said, that's everything Charles Laughton was not. It's not pretentious. Gregory and Laughton had already put on stage some very arty things that had been hugely popular. They had done Don Juan and Hell, the act from Shaw's Man and Superman. They'd done a two-hour version of Stephen Vincent Benet's John Brown's Body, an epic poem, and they created these very artistic stage readings, essentially, reader's theater, that were hugely popular. And they thought they could do it again with Night of the Hunter, take something that is inherently good and audiences will come. Unfortunately, they didn't come to the movie.
Well, everything you're talking about is theater, and Laughton was also a film actor. Had he wanted to direct?
Well, he had been on the road with a series of readings that he did, and he was getting tired of being on the road, crisscrossing the country. And Paul Gregory especially thought it would be better for him to have a directing career, get settled in Hollywood. And Laughton seemed to want that, and they were looking for a project. And Gregory found the Night of the Hunter in galleys. The Harold Matson agency sent it to him, and he bought the thing in galleys. Laughton loved the book, and he thought this would be a great launch for a Hollywood directing career for Laughton.
Because it's so atmospheric.
Atmospheric, and Laughton responded to children very well. Gregory once said Laughton's a child himself, so of course he responded to the children in the book. It's also Davis Grubb's writing is very extravagant itself, and I think Laughton responded to it. He loved what Thomas Wolfe once called the great putter-inners of life, and he loved Thomas Wolfe's writing and Faulkner, and I think he has responded to the lyrical heightened writing of the book.
Well, this was Davis Grubb's first novel, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Was it well received?
Very well received. Yes, actually, it was a bestseller. It was on the bestseller list of the New York Times for about 4 months, and critics across the board liked it very much. And he'd written some short stories here and there, published various places, but this was a big success. And they thought, well, that'll help too. Of course, that'll help to sell the film. And Robert Mitchum and everything seemed to bode well for its success.
Well, in translating it, they had to face the problem of the book being told from a boy's point of view.
Yes, and Laughton captures the child's point of view beautifully at times, but in a very stylized way, which is not in the book. The book is very realistic. It doesn't go off into these expressionist realms of sort of dislocated prose or anything, but Laughton, in trying to capture the children's point of view at times, goes into a very stylized realm. They take this river journey that becomes completely artificial because he said it was a dream for them, and we want to capture that dream.
It's almost German expressionist.
Yeah, it is indeed. Yes, both for the children and for capturing Mitchum's, the Harry Powell's splinter psyche, very bizarre shots. But he used German expressionism in a traditional way in showing, the A-frame image of the bedroom where Willa is murdered. I just gave something away for people out there. She's murdered, and they turn the bedroom into a church through shadow and light, and it's an expressionist way of presenting this death room for her in an ironic way. But he's using German expressionism in a different way for the children, because German expressionism traditionally is getting at the hallucinatory, splintered psyche, as I say, and this is capturing the children's point of view, a sweetness, and he captures a look of barnyard animals, farm animals, a farmhouse, all looking like images from a children's storybook.
My guest is Jeffrey Couchman, who teaches at Fordham University and has also published articles on film and worked on some screenplays as well. And he has written a biography of a film for his latest project called The Night of the Hunter. That's the name of the film, of course. It is published by Northwestern. I was fascinated to learn that Davis Grubb admitted that he was actually influenced by Charles Laughton when he was growing up.
Yes, he said he had always thought of him as the great actor, and it seems as if he'd already known him and worked with him. So by the time he met Laughton, I think he already felt he knew the guy.
Was there an attempt to be faithful to the book?
The script is extremely faithful to the book. They have action, characters, dialogue verbatim. It's extremely faithful in terms of the story. As I say, the style goes off in its own way. That's pure Laughton and Stanley Cortez, the cinematographer. We can't overestimate his contribution here. Very, very faithful otherwise to the book, yes.
Well, the original script was written by James Agee, wasn't it?
Yes.
Now, had he already written the screenplay for John Huston's The African Queen by
yes,
that time?
Yes, he collaborated on that, and he'd written a couple of other adaptations Crane stories, The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky and The Blue Hotel. The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky actually got produced, and he'd done an omnibus television show, Mr. Lincoln. So he was a good screenwriter and was.
But
well,
that's not the way people remember him today. They usually remember him for his prose poem, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, or for his novel, A Death in the Family, or as a film critic for Time Magazine and The Nation.
Yes, that's right. He's gotten his films have been shunted to the side. And, of course, there's been a myth about his original screenplay. He wrote the first draft, and then it just vanished. It disappeared. And legends grew up around it, and people said, oh, the script was 400 pages, and it veered from Grubb's novel. It went off into newsreel footage of the Depression and had nothing to do with the book. None of it could be used. He got fired and sent back to New York. A few years ago, Paul Sprecher of the AG Trust was looking for a keyboard to his son's computer and was looking through boxes in the house and found in a box of books that hadn't been opened for years the screenplay for The Night of the Hunter, the first draft. It is long. It's 293 pages, which is rather big, but it turns out it can lay a lot of myths to rest. The final draft of the screenplay is clearly derived from that first version. It was too long. And in fact, people said he veered away from the novel. It's too faithful to the novel. Practically every scene that Grubb wrote is there. He has a three-long monologue for Ms. Cooper at the end of the book. That monologue turns up as a three-page monologue in the script, which is too much for film. But he did not get fired. He didn't get sent off from the project. Letters have come to light that show he was on the payroll for the entire five-week revision period. And there's a memo from Lawton to AG. So
is he given sole credit for the script?
He is given sole credit. He wrote a letter to Paul Gregory saying, I don't think I should have solo credit. I think I should share it with Charles Lawton. He says, at times, I think Lawton should get solo credit himself. But I back away from that when I think I was maybe a sounding board and a counter-irritant, whatever that means. But so even Lawton felt that maybe, I mean, even AG thought that Lawton had such a hand that he should have solo credit. But I think we can say that it was a collaboration in the end of some sort between Lawton and AG.
How did Lawton cast this film? Because they say casting is 90% of the success of something. We have Robert Mitchum. Shelley Winters, really strong as the sexually starved widow, Willa Harper. Lillian Gish is great in it, perfect as Ms. Rachel Cooper, who winds up protecting the children. And there are the children. Did he direct the children well? Because that's not always the easiest thing to do.
He did, and there's a myth about that as well. People said, well, he didn't know how to direct the children, and he had nothing to do with them. He backed away, and Mitchum has said, I directed the children. But there are hours of outtakes of this film at the UCLA Film and Television Archive, and Lawton kept the camera rolling between takes. So you get to hear him working with the kids, and he works beautifully with the children. He has a lot of trouble with Sally Jane Bruce. She was 4 or 5 years old at the time, and she can't remember a line. She keeps looking into the camera, and he calls her my dear and sweetheart and darling, and the Billy Chapin, he's the young boy, he says, oh, old man, old fellow. I mean, works wonderfully with him to create a very good performance from the kids. So he worked well with the children.
Although I've heard that many of the people in the cast didn't like Shelley Winters.
Well, I think on the whole, what the cast was and crew were very harmonious on this set. Whatever they may have felt personally about this or that person, I know Mitchum and Paul Gregory didn't get along so well, but people put whatever differences there were aside for this production, because over and over you hear from the crew, and I interviewed several of the people, this what a wonderful set and what harmony there was on this movie.
Well, the cinematographer Stanley Cortez once said that of all the directors he'd worked with, only two understood light, Orson Welles and Charles Lawton.
Yeah, it's an amazing tribute to Lawton.
And Lawton only made one film, this film.
That's right. And with this one film, I think we can say he enters the ranks of auteurs. I mean, he puts his stamp on this movie so beautifully.
Why not anymore?
I know more films.
Yeah. The film such a bomb? Because it's considered one of the greatest of all American films nowadays.
It is now. But at the time, in 1955, people just didn't get it. I mean, it's very eclectic. I mean, it has this pastoral side, this sweet, realistic, innocent side, and then it has this German expressionist side. The clash of styles was just strange to people then. And it looks a little, has a kind of horror movie feel, but it's not like a horror movie of the 1950s. It has some film noir elements, but it's
It feels gothic.
Yes, gothic and yet pastoral at the same time, sort of, and it was just out of step with movies of the time and viewers of the time. Of course, now we're used to films that mix styles, mix genres. It's understandable, but he didn't have a chance to direct again, partly because this bomb. He did work on another project with Paul Gregory, though. They were going to do The Naked and the Dead, Norman Mailer's novel, and some of the same people got involved. Hilary Brown was working on for the art direction. Stanley Cortez went off to Hawaii to scout locations. And the thing just never quite got going. Eventually, Lawton himself wrote a script that was too long and had to be revised, and the financing went away. So,
and the final version was not very good. Whoever made it.
Raoul Walsh eventually directed it. Yes.
A great director, but not a great movie.
Not in that film, no.
Can you describe the lengths that Lawton and Stanley Cortez went through to achieve some of the visual effects that make the film so dreamlike? Like The one that's on your cover of Shelley Winter's hair streaming underwater.
Oh, yeah. What a great image. They shot that in a tank at Republic Studios. They had a camera in the water and one outside, and they had huge arc lights to create this incredible glow, and there was a fan blowing the water weeds in her hair. A dummy of Shelley Winter's was used. She's not actually down there in the water. Maurice Seiderman, the wonderful makeup artist from Orson Welles' films, created this wax dummy with the slit in the throat, and they tied that down to the Model T and created this ethereal, beautiful, poetic. It's horrifying and yet poetic. It's a perfect microcosm of the film. It's absolutely the quintessential image of the film.
When did people start realizing that this was a really good film?
Critics in the 70s began to notice. I think film criticism in general sort of took off in the 70s, and there were several articles about it. And as more and more got written about it, it began to get shown in repertory theaters more often, shown on college campuses. I remember screening it at a college campus. Unfortunately, very few people came the night we screened it back at Southern Illinois University. But more and more people began to see it, read about it, and it just became noticed as a unique film. I think what was strange in 1955 became wonderful later on. People said, oh, it's a strange film, but it's wonderful in its strangeness. That's what makes it great. It's not part of the usual stream of Hollywood movies.
Jeffrey Couchman is the author of The Night of the Hunter, a biography of a film from Northwestern University Press, and he will be introducing the 6:30 screening of the film tonight at the Museum of Modern Art. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. This was fun.